Great. So welcome everyone to our first tutorial of the program. Following popular demand, the tutorial will be about light curves, KQED tests. And we're grateful to have two people that have worked very hard on light curves for all these missions, Michael Bones and Ray Wolfman.
All right, awesome. Thanks for coming, everyone. And so over the next hour and a half or so, Michael and I will go back and forth a couple times, and we'll get progressively more hands-on as we go along. But I just want to start with a little bit of introduction to why you shouldn't believe any photometry, basically. All the things that can go wrong with Kepler data, and what happens to it once a photon comes into the telescope, but before it arrives at your laptop. What happens along the way? What are things that can be affected along the way? So you probably think of Kepler photometry as looking something like this. You get handed from a server in Baltimore a flat line at one, occasionally pockmarked by transits. This is beautiful Kepler data. This is Kepler 11. I think of this as Kepler data. You might also think of this, things like stellar rotation signals, astro seismology signals, which this isn't. This is stellar rotation, where you're just seeing a line on your screen go up and down because the star is changing in brightness. This is the end product of a fairly detailed pipeline that creates this. But this isn't like the actual event from Kepler. This is what the Kepler detector looks like. And at its most fundamental, this is what we have to work with. There's about 100 million pixels, 7 million of which are downloaded every 30 minutes, are recorded every 30 minutes, and the entire detector is downloaded about once a month. And there are about 4.5 million stars in the field of view, 200,000 of which on the 7% that are downloaded regularly. So when you get a light curve, this is the end result of some processing of specific pixels on here that are manipulated in many different ways. So let's talk through what that looks like first. And feel free to interrupt if you have any questions or comments along the way. The one really important thing to remember is that Kepler photometry is designed to fulfill the level one requirements of the Kepler mission. The goal of Kepler was to find Earth-sized planets around sun-like stars. And so they tried very hard and very successfully to minimize noise on transit timescales. This can mean at the expense of other timescales. If they had a decision to make where they could do things in different ways, often the intention was to make the decision that optimizes the noise you see on a 6 to 10 hour timescale. If that makes the noise on a week-long or month-long timescale worse, that was the right choice for them. And so if you're looking at a signal on a different time scale, keep this in mind, because what happens to the data might not be the best for your science. And so you might want to do something differently. And so just as an example of that, this is one chunk of data from Kepler. This is called a target pixel file when you download it. This is a file that contains all of the pixels for a specific target. Makes sense why they might call it a target pixel file. And so you can see one star on here. This is the region that's downloaded every 30 minutes, and they take a subset of these pixels to create the light curves that we saw before. In this case, that aperture looks like this. And so you see it more or less matches up with the star that we're looking at here. And if we overlay one on top of the other, yeah, that looks pretty good. You're getting the pixels where there is a star. And you're not really getting pixels where there's not a star. But it's not quite perfect. You'll see that there's a little bit of flux down here. Maybe it's not quite the same dark blue. If we change this to log space, you can see much more effectively there that there's light from the star that's diffusing out of this aperture quite some way. And so you're getting a lot of the starlight, but not all of the starlight. And so anything that would cause the star to move on the detector, if it drifts a little bit this way, some of the starlight falls out of your aperture. And so you would see, if there's coherent motion over a quarter, a slow long-term decrease in the amount of flux you see from the star. Similarly, if it moved more into your aperture, you'd see a long-term increase. Also, the PSF, the shape of this star, can change in time as a function of the temperature of the telescope. So if the telescope is a little hotter, the PSF is broader, and some of the light escapes out of your aperture, and vice versa. And so the first product, this is one product that Kepler delivers. I don't have a presenter mode on, so I'm not sure what the next slide is yet. The first product that's a light curve is called SAP Flux. SAP stands for Simple Aperture Photometry, which is just summing up the pixels that are in that aperture. And so you see here exactly what I was referring to before. There's a long-term trend going down. And so this is because there's a little bit of motion of the star on the detector. And this is causing some of the light to move out of the PSF, or out of the aperture. So you see a long-term decay. If we were to measure the position of the star versus time in X and Y, I don't remember which one is which, you see the star moves over this 30 days of data by about 0.1 pixels. And so, that's a fairly significant amount for a stationary aperture. And so that red curve has the same shape. That's the long-term trend that you see. So that's one effect. The second effect that you have to worry about a little bit is that each pixel has its own sensitivity. In observational astronomy, we call this a flat field, the response of a pixel to a photon. We don't know what the flat field is for Kepler. It was measured before launch, but it's been up in space for 4 years and isn't calibrated regularly. It's been up in space for 10 years, but there are 4 years of the main mission. As things like cosmic rays or micrometeorites hit the detector, it changes the properties of each pixel a little bit in a way that we don't understand. And so pixels can have a couple percent different sensitivity. If you took a star entirely on one pixel and moved it to another pixel, you might see a 2% change in flux. And so as the star moves from a more to less sensitive pixel, you would see that. And then it gets a little worse, because each pixel has a different sensitivity, but the pixels themselves aren't uniformly sensitive. If you were to be able to measure the intra-pixel sensitivity, it's not a top hat function. It looks probably something like this, a parabola, a 2D parabola with a peak near the center of the pixel and falls off on either side. And so if the center of the star is right here, you get more light than if the center of the star is right there. And so if you convolve that with the PSF, you get something like this. Because we can't measure fractions of a pixel, we just measure the total light from an individual pixel, we see this, which is the actual response of the Kepler telescope that we measure. So if a star moves by a fraction of a pixel over and over, you might see some long-term ramps. This isn't a big issue for original OG Kepler because the motion is very slow and pretty stable. And so you just see it move by, like we saw earlier, 0.1 pixels. And it's hard to differentiate between this intra-pixel sensitivity and just aperture losses.
Can you remind us how big the pixels are?
They are just about 4 arc seconds on each side. Yeah.
So how were the masks decided upon, the shapes?
Yeah. It's a function of how bright the star is. But it's a little bit of magic also, because it depends on what they think about other stars in there. They choose what they think will maximize the signal to noise. It's different parts of the detector then, because in the center, your PSFs are a little more compact, and on the edges, they're a little broader. They tend to be pretty small to minimize contamination. They're almost always smaller than the actual PSF. And for your faint stars, your 14th to 16th magnitude stars, they're often 2 to 4 pixels. But they're always smaller than, I think this is true, they're almost always, at least, smaller than the actual TPF. So if you are looking at data and you think there's something weird, there's almost always more pixels you can go back and look at than are used in creating SAP flux.
It's actually documented somewhere how they define the optimal apertures. They didn't try different ones and pick one, but it was calculated beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not. I would guess it's somewhere in the instrument handbook, but I can't point you to a specific section.
It is there. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's based on a catalog plus pre-flight estimates of PSFs. Right. I think it is documented.
Yeah, it's somewhere. It also, and I'll get to this in a couple slides, but Kepler rotates during the year and it ends in four different orientations, and the four positions that it lands on don't necessarily have the same aperture, and in many cases do not have the same aperture. So you can be using more pixels and then have more contamination in certain quarters than you do in others. So this is raw Kepler data. We saw something like this a minute ago. We can compare this to raw data from the K2 mission, where there's much more motion, where the star moves by about half a pixel, and then a thruster fires, repositions everything back where it's supposed to be, the stars move by half a pixel, et cetera, every 6 hours. And so you can really see that intra-pixel sensitivity variations right here. Each of these strips are the star moving onto a less sensitive part of the pixel and back. The Kepler GEO office has put some effort into trying to model that as a parabolic pixel plus an estimate of the PSF. And it works pretty well, actually. It's not perfect, but it's a decent model for what the actual pixels look like. So it's in principle, you could build a forward model of this, but it can be computationally intensive. This is the other thing that I was alluding to. I really like this video of the motion of Kepler during the year. So it's in an Earth-trailing orbit. And it wants to keep its solar panels. We want to keep its solar panels pointed towards the sun. And so every 3 months, it rotates by 90 degrees, which means the entire detector inside rotates by 90 degrees. And so the pixels that Kepler lands on, that stars land on, change every 3 months. But then every year, the pointing is repeatable enough to where it lands on exactly the same pixel it started on. I really like this. There's one thing that annoys me in this animation, which is the first comment is this a scale, which I appreciate. But no, watch the Earth. Like, it's going around, it's rotating, and very suddenly, right about here, it becomes tightly locked. And I was totally cool suspending disbelief until I saw that. And now, but so this is really important for us, that you have essentially four different experiments going on for each star. You have once a year, you end up back on the same pixel. So in quarters 4, 8, 12, 16, you're looking at the same star in the same part of the detector. But it's a different part of the detector than 1, 5, 9, 13, and 2, 6, 10, 14, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you see something interesting that only happens one out of every four quarters, that's a good sign you're looking at a systematic. But if you see it in each of the four different orientations, you can have some confidence that it's not a detector issue, at the very least. This does mean because each pixel has a different sensitivity and a different aperture is used in different orientations, and your exact position relative to the aperture, the rotation isn't an integral number of pixels necessarily, and so you land between pixels where you didn't before, means there's an offset every quarter. And so if you look at years of Kepler data, or in this case, three quarters of Kepler data, you can see that there's a big jump from one quarter to another. That's, I think, Q1, Q2, Q3 from Kepler. So in Q2, either there's a larger aperture or a more contaminated aperture, or just the star is better positioned in the aperture, so you get 5% more flux. And in Q3, the opposite is true.
What would make it more contaminated?
If there's so say you had a few pixels that looked like this, and you had a star right here, and your aperture looked like this, but there's another star right here.
Oh, and if there's some change.
Exactly. So if in Q1 they use this aperture, but in Q2 they use this aperture, and you're getting light from that, that's what I'm going to be working at. Yep. And you can see some of these other features in here. This ramp is thermal effects. So once a month, Kepler points back to Earth to downlink its data, and then points back towards the Kepler fields. And so thermally, it's not in equilibrium for a couple days. And so the detector is at a different temperature, and so the PSF is broader or shallower. And so it takes a couple days to re-thermally equilibrate, and you get this change in sensitivity during that.
Why is that worse in some quarters than others?
Why is that worse in some quarters than others? Because probably in this quarter, the star, there's some feature that's closer to either the edge of the aperture or the edge of a pixel. And so here, if it's breathing, but the entire aperture is larger than the size of the breathing, then you wouldn't see it as much.
Some of the big ramps are also due to safe modes.
Right? Yeah, so, that's true.
When something happens, spacecraft will need safe mode and just restart the observation. So those are also safe thermal effects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So long-term trends, just to drive that home, are overwhelmed by quarter-to-quarter systematics. If you're trying to see something that's, you know, a fairly small effect, like a stellar activity cycle, over years, for the sun that might be 0.1%, it's really hard to tease that out when you have a 5% offset from quarter-to-quarter. So there's a couple ways to remove instrumental effects. And the Kepler team and the test team use one called PDC, pre-search data conditioning, and they create this PDC SAP flux, pre-search data condition, simple aperture photometry flux. Flux is not an acronym in this case. But their goal is to remove anything that is coherent between stars and the detector. So you're going to give more details on PDC?
Yeah.
Okay, so I won't go into significant details, just going to say how it messes up your data. PDC tries to remove things shared between stars and tries to, I said remove here, I'm going to change it to account for contamination from nearby stars. Here's a nice figure showing a couple stars in the field of view at a higher resolution. And once I put this in, I learned these aren't actually the Kepler pixels, so just pretend they are for a minute. Wouldn't it be cool, though? And so you have nearby stars that are in the background. Your aperture tends to be, you know, 4 or 8 pixels, something like that. And so you have lots of background stars that are contributing to your flux and diluting your signals. And so the Kepler team has estimates of all these nearby stars, how bright they are in the Kepler bandpass. And so they assume if these stars are stable, there's a certain contamination that they're providing into your light curve. And so they will increase the amplitude of signals as part of PDC. If your star, for example, is contributing half the flux, then the transit depth you measure is half as deep as it should be. And that's corrected in moving from SAP to PDC. This assumes you know exactly the brightness of your other stars here. It assumes they're not varying. If the signal you're looking at is actually a background EB, that's, you know, very deep eclipses, they're not going to be removed by this process. And also, I said this already, but it's important, assumes you know what the contamination is. If these stars are actually fainter than you think they are, then the contamination will be wrong, the correction is wrong. If they're missing stars, if one of these stars, the star that you care about, is actually a very close binary that can be resolved in high resolution, you're missing contamination, and so that would make your signals artificially too shallow. So there's lots of assumptions that are baked into our transit depths from that. The other step is to remove things that are shared between modes and detectors. They take a bunch of nearby stars, do something that looks a lot like PCA, and create these eigenlight curves that are the dominant modes of what all stars are doing on the detector. As you see, the most common thing that all these stars nearby this particular target that I chose at random are doing is ramping up in time. Then there are some other features as well. And then divide these out from the SAP flux to get the PDC value. And so here's an example of just some stars that are on one piece of the detector as SAP flux, and then the same stars as PDC when the CBVs have been divided out. And so you see, for example, the top left one gets to be pretty flat. That's great, cool. And the shape of things generally change a little bit, and short-term structure is preserved because the long-term trends, the systematics are generally long-term trends. So there are pros and cons to this. There's a significant pro if you're trying to find transits, in that transits are going to be preserved, and a flat line with little transits in there are exactly what we want when we're doing search. The downside is, this is probably a systematic along here, but what if you had a star with a rotation period of 300 days, or a Mara variable or something that has variability on year or years timescales? That's going to get completely washed out by the PDC correction. And so it's really hard to measure signals that have timescales comparable in length to a quarter for this reason. TEST is the same thing. When they make their two-minute targets, they have their pipeline is essentially the Kepler pipeline. But a test sector is only 27 days. So where Kepler, you lose things that are similar to 90 days, TEST, you lose things similar to 27 days and longer. So things like the solar rotation period would get washed out. So we have to think carefully about the right ways to protect the sun when its analogs are observed by TEST. At the end of the day, then, here's processed Kepler data. It looks pretty nice. There's still a couple features here. You can see discontinuities here and there. Here's a transit. That's great. Occasional outliers, high and low, that might be astrophysical, might be solar flares, might be instrumental, might be cosmic rays, things like that. But generally, you can dig in a little bit at the pixel level and see, is this something that's shared by all the pixels and it's probably astrophysical, or is it something that's on one specific pixel and then it's probably instrumental? The other thing is we still have the jumps here from one quarter to the next. Those aren't corrected because the dividing out doesn't know anything about what the absolute value of the star's phenometry is. And it's done on a quarter by quarter basis. The pipeline doesn't know anything about any other quarter when it corrects the quarter it's working on. This is another slide that I probably want to say something about. So really important to remember, signals with a timescale similar to the length of the observing session, a quarter for Kepler, a month for TESS, are removed by the processing pipeline really, really effectively. Other potential issues that I just wanted to highlight, there's crosstalk between the different parts of the detector. And so you can occasionally have signals from one part of the detector that are actually from a really far away part of the detector. This is a nice figure from Jeff Coughlin's paper from 2013. Any line you see is connecting two signals, two planet signals with the same period and phase. And so lots of them, you can see ones, like these two are connected. They're only a few pixels apart, so that might make sense that you just have apertures that are close and overlapping. Maybe a star is saturated and bleeds onto another one. But then you can see stars on right across one channel here, or one module, kind of symmetrically affect each other. So that's an effect you have to watch out for. And also there's crosstalk over a 180-degree rotation on the instrument. So there's this cluster of stars that all have the same period and phase. And this signal right over here has the same signal. And then from here to here. And these are stars separated by 10 degrees on the sky. You wouldn't necessarily think about that as a false positive. But it is something worth considering. Just when you find a new planet, make sure it's not with the same period and phase as another planet. It's unclear how important that is for tests at the moment. This case will certainly be very important because the pixels are much larger for tests. They're 5 times the size, so 25 times the area. So you have a lot more chance to get a nearby false positive contaminant. Another issue is what they call a rolling band noise. There's some electronic talk that they now understand and have explained to me a couple times that I don't deeply understand. Anyone else know like what drives rolling band noise? It's some clock on one of the something constructively interfering with another clock and something else in a really high resonance. It's 2 gigahertz frequency things that happen to be not quite at the same frequency and so cause interference on a 3-day timescale. And so you can see that there's a whole region of things from K2. This is K2, you can see all sorts of asteroids going through. But you can see the whole field breathes a little bit and gets brighter and fainter over 3 days. And this is an additive signal, not multiplicative. But if you're looking at very faint things, you tend to see a 3-day period in them because of this feature. And the third issue is what they call a sudden pixel sensitivity dropout. This is when a pixel suddenly drops out its sensitivity. They're really well named, actually. This is the result of a cosmic ray hit. Cosmic ray hits the detector. One pixel is significantly affected and for a little while becomes less sensitive to photons. Depending on how the cosmic ray hits it, this can be something that's more or less permanent or temporary. Sometimes you see them ramp right back up. This one you can see kind of ramp up over, so here's the SPSD, and it ramps up over a couple weeks maybe. Each one is a little bit different, but they're all this sharp discontinuity down and then slow increase in signal going back up. So if you're looking for transits, which are kind of defined by sharp features going down, if your data aren't processed in the right way, you can be confused by these. So one thing that I believe pretty strongly is that there are all these PDC and SAP light curves that are produced, but it's very rarely a bad idea to go back to the pixel level data and start from there. And it's very often a good idea to do that. So if you see something weird in your data and you're not getting the pixel level data, usually the first thing I suggest is, have you looked at the pixels? What's going on a pixel by pixel basis? And that's a really good way to gain intuition about what you're seeing. So that's all I wanted to say about systematics and things that can go wrong. And so Mikhail's going to talk about how you get the data next, and then we'll get into actually playing with it.
Yes. Okay. So, I need that. On the computer. Yeah. I think that should be the one. Okay. So I'm gonna sit down for most of it because I'm gonna be switching to web pages and try out some live coding stuff, and so it's probably better that I sit down for that. But yeah, I'll start out with how you access some of the Kepler data and test data and K2 data. First, the normal databases, and then go into some more details on the basic use of the light curve module. And then after that, briefly go through how you can some of the things that Ben have already mentioned, how you can correct some of your data, and also how you might try these out using light curves. So we'll try it along the way. So given that I'm not entirely sure how many
actually work every day with Kepler data. I started with the very basic. So the very basic, how you get Kepler data, is that you go to MAST. We will see with Lightcurve that you might not need to do that anymore. But that's the basic thing. So if you're not used to it, you should maybe try and go here. So for K2, for instance, you can search in the databases. I would start with the EPIC search. So there's both the data search, where you only access actual data products, and then there's the EPIC, with the input catalog for the mission. So if you just search the EPIC for a given star, you will see something like this. So a catalog of all the parameters listed by MAST, a lot of colors, a lot of magnitudes. And the important thing here is the data availability. So for a lot of stars, you might see zero here. That just means it's in the catalog, but it hasn't been observed. But if, in this case, we are lucky, fortunately. So you press the data availability, you'll see that it has been observed in campaign 13, in non-cadence mode. And this is the only data there is for the star. And then you can also look at the proposals that suggested this star to see if there's anything interesting for it.
Can I ask you a question about downloading data?
Yes.
If one wanted to download the, like, all Kepler light curves.
Yes.
Or all K2 light curves.
I think MAST has a bundle download. So there you can basically get a VGET script that you just run and then it downloads to your computer. And we have some of the same for the KSOC and TSOC databases. I'm not entirely sure just where to find that right now.
I think I've seen that before.
You can get the VGET scripts. But if you're just interested in a single star like here, you'll click at the data set, and then it will show you a plot of the different light curves that Ben also mentioned, so the simple aperture photometry, and then the pre-search data-conditioned simple aperture photometry. So we can plot both of them, and then you can download the data, both the target pixel file and just the extracted light curve. So that is very simple, and it's the same for the Kepler mission, so the setup looks the same. And I should say that I'm using the old design of MAST, because I mean the new thing looks like this, and I have no idea how to navigate that yet. So I would still prefer the old version. That works better for me.
You also don't have that
in the past.
Yeah. And these will get things out in the next year or so. They have a new search that they're building.
So there's a learning curve now. But.
So there will be a new search. It's not just all of them.
Yes.
So there will be an extra that's similar.
That is vaguely similar to this, but built with a better backend. Think about it, and it's like the same. It's similar typically to the new ADS.
Which I also
have a sensitive talk.
The next thing, if you're not in the seismic community, you probably don't know about KSOC or TSOC, but this is the Kepler Astroseismic Science Operations Center, but it's a database. So it's not a center, but it's a database. The same thing for TESS, it's just the TESS astrocyte. So it's a copy-paste of the two websites. But I would encourage you to go there and sign up. If you're not already a member, it's open access, so there is a password, but you just sign up and say that you want to be part of the data correction working group, which is the one that I lead, and then you're in. So Kepler, the KSOC looks something like this, and you have a lot of functionality to both find information about a lot of stuff going on in the seismic community, but you also have nice things like, okay, I need to log in. Yes, that works. nice, something like the star catalog is very nice. So, for instance, we had Kepler 10, let's say. Search for that, you can see which quarters have been observed and which mode. Some information about some of the ground-based data. This is not complete, by the way, but the publications, the classification, and even for this mode, you have this might be only visible to me, by the way. some analysis results from modeling, and you know, simple things that just grab from SIMBAD. You can see a field of view, and you can even open it in SIMBAD too, so you learn more. And so that's a very nice thing, the star catalog. You can also do the data search, where you can search for a lot of different things. We'll try just the basic. Let's see what it comes. So you can select what you want to look at, but then you can see all the data we have for this, all the campaigns. That's a lot, actually. And if there's different, has been different processing versions of the data, they're also listed here. And you can see a quick part of it and a power spectrum. So that's very nice for seismologists, at least. This is the uncorrected data, by the way. So that was a very brief introduction to KSOC and now TASOC, which will take over TESS. And again, you can sign up for free and look at what all the working groups are doing. And I'm sure you can use some of that for your own research. And here, a nice thing is also the tick search. Oh, Jesus. which is a very nice way of accessing the entire catalog, because you can like search in coordinates on the sky, magnitude colors, properties, if we have them from somewhere, to get samples from the tick. And there it will also tell you which sectors it has, a given star has been observed in, if it has been observed. Given that our processing so far hasn't been uploaded to MAST, it's happening as we speak, you can also go to the data releases and look at some of the raw photometry that we have processed so far for the first two sectors. So that was the very brief introduction to those databases, but do sign up. So the next thing is Lightcurve and trying to actually play around with some of the data. And this is a very, Lightcurve is, so it's developed by the K2 Geo office. And it's a very nice tool, even if you are very used to working with data from TESS or Kepler all the time, it's a very nice tool to have a quick look at your data and try simple things to see how your star behaves, or your planet, if that's what you want. And also for people who are not used to working with Kepler data, it's a really nice tool to access it. So you should all have done this before you came. And the upgrade is good if it's a long time since you have installed Lightcurve, because then you might not have the capabilities for tests.
They update it like once a week or something.
Yeah, so yeah. There's new functionality all the time. but we'll see along the way when we get to the test example if you can run it. So just to run Lightcurve, I will use the Jupyter QT console because I'm not really a notebook person. But if you like notebook better, or just normal IPython, or just a normal Python console, if you can deal with that, that's fine. But I'll run the Jupyter console. So And now I'll have to rely on my notes. Okay, I should just look there. So let's start by importing LightCurve. SLK in this case, and LightCurve with a K.
And no space.
And no space. Yes. Very similar to the Danish spelling, actually, with K. I like that. And we will also just import pyplot. So, and that should be all we need to download or import. So the most, one of the most basic functions of LightCurve is the search for LightCurves, and this will search for LightCurves that has been processed from the Kepler mission, so SAP or PDC SAP flux. So if we start by creating a LightCurve file object, which is LightCurve, and then because we're using IPython, you have you can make tab completion, so you can see all the functions possible. So in this case, we'll try search LightCurve file, and then again, just IPython, you get all this information. I'll just make this larger. So the key input is a kick or an epic ID or a tick ID. In principle, you can put in whatever you like and it will try to figure it out yourself, or you can be nice and specify the mission if you think it's needed. But we'll just type in a kick ID, and I will try to get this right. So this is, if you can recognize the telephone number, this is HAPPY7, Kepler 2, KY2, whatever you want to call it, obviously. And we'll just look at a given quarter 6, and we will download. So if you didn't push, if you didn't take the download, and if you didn't add the quarter, but just executed the LightCurve search, it would tell you all the files that are available, and then you can access them afterwards. But
and
now
you would have to access them one by one. You cannot put all of them.
We can. I mean, if you just didn't set the quarter, but just said download, you can actually say download all. And don't specify the quarter, you would get all there. And then you can access it as a, this is then a LightCurve file object that you can access. But now we just have the LightCurve file object for quarter 6. So LightCurve has some nice plotting utilities, so we can just say plot. And that just shows nothing, so we'll, in my case at least, just say show, and this is what we get. So we can see that LCF here is a Kepler LightCurve file object, and it contains then two LightCurves, the SAP and the PDC SAP flux plotted together here. But if we just want to extract one of them, we could call it LightCurve PDC. That would then be the LightCurve file, and then PDC SAP flux, and there you can tap complete as well. So now we have isolated that. So now C is, you'll see it changed to be a LightCurve file to just be a LightCurve object. So this is the thing you will work with mostly, and it has a lot of attributes, of course. C dot flux give you the flux of the time series. You can also access the time, of course, and it has a lot of metadata, such as mission. It's Kepler. Good to know. Water, 46 as we download it. And you can also do things like, so again, if we tap here, we can see all the possible things we can do to this light curve object. So one could be estimate CDPP, like that. So you can do a lot of...
Does that calculate from a light curve, or is that what's in the fixed header, for example?
I think it's in the fixed header for this, because it's a downloaded light curve. Yeah. And of course, you can then also.
I think it calculates that.
Okay.
You can give it a.
You can.
Size, a transit duration.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. So you can specify also if you want a different timescale CDPP. And so it's not the standard. This is the standard CDPP for Earth, like whatever. But you can change the other transit duration and so on. And of course, as you could with the light curve file object, with the light curve object, you can also do the plot. And it will plot that. Okay, so that was just a basic light curve search, and all that is specified here. So, I mean, it's more or less going through the tutorials on the light curve page anyway. But you can go to here to find the functions as well. As Ben said, it's more or less always a good idea to go to the pixels. So we'll do that now. So instead of just searching for the processed light curve, we'll try to look at the target pixel file. So we define target pixel file as light curve dot, and then we want to search again, and you can see the options. So we want to search target pixel file. We will put in the same star, FP7 again. Let's take the same quarter and download that. So we might destroy EduRome now, but that's fine. Okay, so TPF is now a Kepler target pixel file object. So as with the light curve file object, we can access things like the time, and we can also access the flux, but given that this is a pixel file now, it will not just be one array of flux values, it will be a 3D array. So if we just look at the shape of this, you see that this is actually a 15 by 11 pixel stamp, and there are 4,276 of them for all the time steps. So this is just a data cube. We can also look at things like what went into defining the simple aperture photometry from Kepler that we downloaded earlier. So we can actually look at something like TPF, and again, a lot of different options you could look at. But if we want to look at something like the pipeline mask, this is the aperture that was used by the mission. It's just a Boolean array. And you can see there's some truths in here. We'll try to plot it in just a second. But the thing is that you can also manipulate this mask and basically just define your own 2D array of ones and zeros to set a different aperture. But if we don't,
sorry?
So if you want to define a different aperture, you can just modify this. So change this false to true, for instance, then you add that pixel. So you can put in whatever aperture you want here. But let's then try and plot the pixel data. So more or less all the objects has this plot functionality. But again, because this is a data cube, we want to, it's difficult to plot everything in a just a simple plot. So we need to specify that we need, that we want to look at a specific frame. So we just look at the first frame. And apologies for this. Yeah. And we can add other things to make the plot a bit nicer. We can set the scale, for instance, to block, so we can better see what the star is doing. And then we need to define, if we don't do anything, no, sorry. If we want to plot the aperture, also we need to specify it here. So we specify aperture mask, and then we just set it to the TPF pipeline mask to plot that on top. And this looks something like this. So now you have the target pixel file, and you have the aperture used in order 6. You can also, in a minute we'll go to then producing light curves where we can change the aperture. But the last very important thing about these target pixel file objects is also, of course, you can get the header from the pixel files so that you can see more or less all the information for this star and this quarter. So similar to opening it in whatever FITS program you want, you can access all the header information for this star. So that is very nice. But if we then want to actually try to make a light curve from our pixel data, we can do that as well. So I will just overwrite the light curve file from before, and I will estimate it from the target pixel file. So target pixel file has a functionality that's called to light curve. Super easy, and you can see that the default method here is the aperture. You can also use PRF, so the pixelated PSF is the PRF, and you can use that to also fit your data. I tried it for this, and it takes like 4 minutes, so we're not going to do that. And they will also write that it's in experimental settings, so you should be cautious in using that. So the default is the aperture, but then of course we want to define our aperture. So let's see. Aperture mask. Thanks. So we set that again to the pipeline mask from before. So in essence, we should just derive again the simple aperture photometry. Okay, so now again, LCF is a Kepler light curve object. We can plot it, and then we might also just have a look at what difference it makes to have another aperture. So instead of, we call this light curve file 2, instead of using the standard aperture, let's try just and saying that we want to use all the pixels, because let's assume we don't know how we should set it. So now we have two light curve files, so we want to try and plot them together. So our first pipeline one, just put a red color on that. Okay. And then we wanna add the other one. So it's a plot. And here we define that the axis should be the axis object we defined just before for the other plot to plot them together. Of course, if you're building scripts, you don't need to do these sort of things. But. So here they're plotted together. So basically, it makes very, very little difference what kind of aperture you set for HP7, because it's so bright compared to its surrounding pixels. But you could, of course, play around with setting, making small changes to the apertures. And I should say that LightCurve also has, in when running it in a notebook, it can have an interactive mode where you can pick and choose pixels and look directly at the impact on the light curve. But we'll not try that here, but you should do that afterwards if you want.
And how the original, the one, the pipeline one that we saw, how was that set to begin with? That was the Kepler team that?
Yeah, that was the Kepler team. So that's to optimize or minimize the CDBP in this 13-hour timescale.
So this is automatic. When they get it, they automatically go through every single light curve and do this. They have a pipeline that does.
Yeah. That's the Kepler processing pipeline. Yeah, it does that. And as Ben mentioned before, based on information or a catalog of the PSFs across the detector, how if you land, if you have a star that lands here, your PSF looked like that, what sort of aperture should you do to optimize the signal to noise?
And have people use a different mask that gives them a very different result?
Yes.
Oh.
So typically as Ben said, that for faint stars, that often leads to 1 to 3 pixel apertures, and it never really covers the PSF fully. So often in Kepler or for the seismology, we have used bigger masks because it seems to be better at mitigating some of the systematics also. Because again, if you have your star moving in and out of your aperture, it imprints on the light curve. But if you make the aperture larger and capture all the flux, then it might be less. So for a lot of the seismology work, we have used another way of setting the apertures. So yeah, but go to the pixel data. That's very important. Where is the mouse? That's here. Okay, so that was this. Okay, so a nice functionality that the slide I added 5 minutes before going here, and you might not be able to run this if you don't have the code called K2Flix. You can say pip install K2Flix and it should work. But there is a very nice tool on Mast, hosted at Mast also, called TestCut. So I'm just gonna try this out, see if it works. So if you just search for TestCut, you'll get here. And the idea is that you can use this for tests to make a cutout of the FFIs. Eleanor has something similar that you can use on the fly, but this is for tests particularly because the background is an issue. It's nice to get a pixel cutout, and then with K2Flix you can make a movie, a simple GIF in a few seconds. So you can see if there's some band of scattered light that moves across your star. So if we just try this out, let's say we want a 20 by 20 pixel mask, and I put the star in hoping Pierre would be here because that's his binary from yesterday. We just refresh sectors. So it has been observed in 2 sectors. Let's take sector 1. And then we download the cutouts. Okay, and I already downloaded it, of course, so I won't do that again. But if we then go, so you don't need to do the K2 flicks now, but if you did that, you would basically just say K2 flicks to this cutout. See if it works. And it works. And now it has created. Okay, that's over here. I'm very confused by my mouse here. Sorry. No, you'll just see my folders here. That's fine. So it looks something like this. Okay, that was the downlink in the middle. But so nothing really bad is happening here. That's good. But in some cases, you will see this straight line moving in, and you will see a lot of wiggles in your time series. And if you're not careful, you might interpret that as something completely different than what it is.
So if that were the case, then what do I do? Like, just take out those? Can you take out those time spans?
Either that, or you try to estimate the background in a more global sense. And the idea is that, so we are working on making that global background and adding it as a data product. And also, the idea is that it should interact with light curves, so that if you actually use TestCut or whatever, it will have the proper background. So that's the idea. But yeah, just a cautionary note. So, okay, that was TestCut and K2 Flix.
I think light curve can calculate power spectra, right?
Yes. It has, I'm not that happy about it because the last times I looked at it, the normalization was way off.
You mean amplitude normalization?
Yeah. Let's just see. We can try this here. Hold to periodogram or something. So I'm not sure what the format is going to be with this. This is nice, doing it on the fly.
Yeah, sorry to put you on the spot.
Okay, that didn't work. A few of the very, very often used functionalities is the remove NANDs. See if this works. Okay, P is a Lomsdagen periodogram, and it has, let's just try.
They're changing the normalization right now.
Yeah.
there's a warning that the default normalization is about to change. I think there's been a lot of discussion recently about that.
Yeah. I don't know what that is. Power spectrum is complicated.
So this is exactly what you would expect for a planet host, the period, the time scale. Yeah. So, good. Yes, very nice. But yeah, it has that functionality as well if you want to do quick look things with it. But I would say that you should be very, yeah. I think you can actually specify that also. You can specify the units for everything. I would say you should be very cautious in using light curve directly for your science. I mean, it's good for quick looks and stuff. But, yes, okay. So what I wanted to show next was briefly the stitching. Because, for instance, for Happy 7, we have a lot of data. So let's just start again with trying to make the light curve file, and it's quarter one. And then the nice thing when you get into light curve is that you start to just add functionality. That's dot this. And you can more or less do a full first analysis in one line. Download, and then we want the PDC set flux. And tap complete because there's a download yet. But so we want this light curve, the first quarter, and then let's just do for Q in range, start with then quarter 2 to 10. And then we need to update our light curve so you can use append. And then we add, copy this. But of course, change the quarter to Q.
So can you not do the download all and then just take the PDC side plans?
I think you need to do an index on the object.
Yeah, when you do download all, it gives you a list of light curve files, so you still have to manually combine them like this. I think part of the idea with that is that you have to be a little careful with normalization between quarters when you're combining them. I think if you want to stitch, I think it always looks something like this.
Of course, instead of just a search light curve, you could have done the full search GPF. Do the two light curve with a different aperture in the one line instead. But now we just want to look at the PDC flux. So it needs to download a bit more now. Okay. So before I plot the full thing, I'll just try another stitching with an added functionality. So I'll just first define an axis again. So this already makes a plot, but we'll then try the same thing again. Let's call it light curve 2. But now we add the normalize. So basically, it just divides by the mean or the median, whatever method it uses. So, no, that's fine. Good. And then here, yes, and add. Okay, so now we have the two light curves with different, the one not normalized and the other one normalized. So we can do a plot. Let's do a scatter and then define the axis to be the one we just did before. So here you see all this stuff that Ben was talking about. The jumps between individual quarters, and then just the normalized light curve. So as with the remove nans, the normalize and the remove outliers is something that you use often in processing. Okay. So Okay, the next thing I wanted to try.
Sorry, and can
yes.
why is it going like this? Like why?
It's because it's scatterplot.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is a planet like this, but because of the period.
It's the aliasing of the planet signal.
Yeah.
This hand scale.
We can try. Can I just plot? We have a lot of transits here.
Because these points are just every 30 minutes, you're getting one point in the ingress and one point in the egress, and there's a change in where they are relative to the transit change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So that's why you. Basically.
Yeah, so it looks like curtains, but it's not.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
<That's> awesome. okay. So the next thing I wanted to try was doing basically just the same, but with tests. So here we'll see if your light curve is upgraded. So let's just find a target pixel file object again. And we have search target pixel file. So the tick here is PS EB. And we saw earlier that it, and again, actually let's just try and do like this.
How does it know it's a tick?
Yeah.
It's a tick ID, it's just a number of digits, because it's just not. Surely the tick ID overlaps with the kick ID at some point.
I think mostly it doesn't. If it does, then it does the right, it does some default. But I think, but it's better, you should always put this the identifier, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, you can also if you put, you could also put tick and make it a string and put ticks in front of that. That would work as well.
So you write a string that's tick 1 or 2.
Yeah.
So for this one, you can see.
But mostly it works.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
All of the kicks are 6, 7, or 8 digits.
Yeah, but K2 is 20 million. So surely there's some overlap. Because the kick, we just started with 0 and went as high as it could. So it must be
We'll see when it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, the tick numbers perhaps haven't been observed yet. They're not going to knock it in again. Mm-hmm. It will happen.
the tick starts, there's a tick 1.
I think so.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it didn't start.
When are the tick IDs going to
be? I would love to know the answer to that. I got up there quick, so they can handle.
That's what I was like, why is it not there yet?
Okay, so just from the search, we can see that there are two things that can be downloaded from sector 6 and 7. So it's just if you want to check what's there. So let's just download the sector 6. I think it's the targets it's finding, and then the distance to the target you search for.
Maybe you can put in coordinates.
Yeah.
If you put in coordinates, I'll show you the distance.
Yeah, so you can do like AstroPy coordinates as well, search in a region.
If you equal anything, you just. Oh, okay.
So again, just to remind you that TPF has the header, so there you can also find information, for instance. Now we know that what we downloaded, but if you want, you can access the header as well. So let's try and just do plots. 0 again, and with just to have a look at data. So this is the star. This is given that this is short chain size, this is then the aperture that the test mission defined. Seems a bit small. but in any case, let's try and have a look at the light curve. And again, if we don't do anything, it will just use this aperture. Huh. Have a very nice signal. Not in need of a lot of correction.
What's happening in the middle, in the triangle there?
That's the data downlink, so there's just no data here. So it's just connecting two points. It's just, that's why it looks so,
it's connecting to a point up
there. Yeah, there must be a point up there. Yeah. So that would be the blip you saw in the movie before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so another thing you could look at, because again for the 2 minute cadence data, which is these stamps, there will be a background estimate, which will, as far as I know, just be more or less the average, trying to find isolated pixels, but then just one value for the entire frame. And that will be your background for the stamps. So the message is that might be wrong.
So just whatever is not in aperture, but in that, all
yeah,
the pixels.
I mean, they might. I'm sure they try to deselect some of the bright pixels, okay, and then try to take some of the fainter pixels to estimate a background level. But we can actually look at sort of what the light curve for the background looks like. So there is a get background light curve. So let's try and plot that. Oh, it's actually picking up the transits. So Pierre should maybe look at his steps a bit again, because the background seems to be stealing away some of the signal. So again, this is a good way to check that what your data is doing is actually what it should be doing. Okay, so that was the basics of light curve and how to access the data. So of course, all the commands is on these slides. Okay, so going into the detrending part of it, or the correcting, because correcting is, I mean, it means different things to different people. So seismologists would correct away a planet signal because it's noise. As you saw from the HATP7 power spectrum that we made earlier, that there's spikes all over and you can't see anything. But there is a lot of seismology to do there if you remove it. So correcting is in quotes here. But of course, the simplest thing that you could do is what you would call detrend, to just try to filter some signal depending on what you look at. So typically for seismology, for instance, it would be high pass filtering to just remove everything that varies on a long time scale, because either that's activity or something else that can destroy our signal. It will not work for planets, of course. But in Lightcurve, the simplest way to do just a simple detrending or filtering is with the dot flatten method. So flatten will run a Savitsky-Colai filter, and you define the window length here. So super simple, and you can add it to all these dot remove NANDs, dot remove outliers, dot flatten, and then you have a reasonable first look at your light curve. But again, don't use it for science, I would say. That's dangerous. And a lot of the stuff that we've been doing in the seismic community has been based on exactly a detrending rather than a co-trending, as we'll come to in a bit. So the detrending, just example in this case, there is a, in this case, actually a lot of high frequency noise and some low frequency noise. But using the filter we developed called the KSOC filter, which is a band pass-ish filter, so it doesn't really have a window function that's properly defined, but it can filter away both long variability signals, and then try to isolate the seismic signals. So just, I mean, if you have heard about the KSOC filter, it might be nice to know what it actually does. So the basic idea is to just run a bunch of moving median filters, because they're very robust and we need to do it for a lot of targets. So first, we remove the jumps, which we'll not discuss, and Ben also showed that there's jumps that needs to be removed, but we remove them somehow by normalizing to the ends of one quarter to the next. And then the idea with the KSOC filter is to run iteratively a number of moving medians, first one with a long time scale to isolate long-term trends. Then with K2, we added a position-dependent one that will do more or less the self-flat-fielding method that Vandenberg developed, which we'll also try using Lightcurve in a bit. And if you have known planets, you would, with known periods, make a phase curve, try to isolate the planetary signal. And then removing these contributions from the light curve, you have another median filter with a short window to look at very sharp transient things. And then you iterate this whole thing. So in the end, you actually end up being able to separate the different contributions. And the final filter is then a weighted sum of the different filters. Okay, so the idea is that we use a turnover function like this, which is a cumulative normal distribution, and that works on the scatter of this V prime. So I'm sorry if it gets a bit difficult to follow, but the idea with this V parameter is that you look at the difference between the long-term filter and the short-term filter. So if the two follow each other, V will be close to zero. But if you then all of a sudden have a very sharp feature on top of your long-term trend, they will deviate a lot, and then the scatter will increase for V. So you use this to capture, for most of the light curve, your C value would be close to zero. So you would build your filter based on the long-term trends. But then if there's a very sharp thing happening, you would make a turnover and use the short filter instead. So you can bandpass in this way, removing both times of variability. So of course, if you didn't have a phase curve, the short-term filter would typically take care of your transits and remove that. But if you have it, it's much nicer to use the full phase curve to remove the transit. So Unfortunately, we don't have a nice tool that this is very accessible by. This is very running only on our servers in Aarhus. So, but if you hear that something comes from KSOC, you will know that this is what we do. And the thing is that it's more or less only good for solar-like oscillators, where your signal looks like stochastic noise. Because if you have like a delta scuti or something with a very coherent oscillator, running median filters against through it is a very bad idea. So in developing this, we were very biased to the solar-like seismology side because that's what we do. But an example of running this is shown here for HADP7 that we looked at before. So this is just a raw aperture photometry. And you see again what Ben mentioned, that every four quarters, you more or less return to the same state because you're back on the same CCD. And all the width of these lines is actually just the transit. So if we try to stitch the gaps, look like this. And then we run the filter, which also removes the planet. So, I mean, all of this you see down here is the planet. So in the end, we end up with a cleaned light curve where you have plus minus 500 ppm signal, which is our, which we want to use for seismology. So, of course, given that it iterates, it can work with multi-planet systems and remove those as well. So that was sort of the simplest way of, I mean, not quite the simplest, but in a detrending way to correct your data.
So when you say that you remove the planet, what is effectively what you're
doing? We divide
the data, or
no? I mean, we try to use the, if we know the planetary period, we try to build a phase curve to have an empirical model for the planet, and then use that as a part of our filter to divide out the planet.
So you use the intransit data and throw it away, which you've
been
for a very long time before.
I mean, there might be issues still with using intransit data because you're not looking at the full star anymore, but we will, forget about that. So, yeah, this sort of detrending approach has been used a lot for seismology, at least. The other method that that Ben mentioned was using the CBVs. So the idea is that you build a large array of all your light curves, and then you run a principal component analysis, typically using SVD, to find principal component basis vectors that describe the behavior that's common among all your light curves. There's a lot of steps in this to actually get good CBVs out. So first of all, you typically want to filter out light curves that are very variable. That's not where the variability is not dominated by systematics at all, because they can add noise to your CBVs. And in some cases, you can end up building CBVs, and if you then check the contributions from individual stars, you'll see that one star seems to dominate the signal in this CBV. Of course, you want to remove that star and then do the process again. So there's a lot of iteration in actually deriving these CBVs. But the basic idea is then, in the end, that you make a linear combination of your CBVs, and then you minimize the difference to your light. So a few examples of the CBVs that we have built for tests look like this. So you see a lot of systematics, and typically on this two-week timescale, which is the orbit. And in our case, we also separate out spikes and things from momentum dumps and so on. But the basic idea is then that you fit these to your data. So I thought we could try that for some Kepler data. It's not implemented yet for tests. But we could try it for Kepler.
Just as a time check.
Oh, yeah.
I think people have just stuck around.
Now it's mainly just, yeah, a few examples here. So
you given where we are in time, maybe others in Slack.
Depends on what people want to hear about more, I guess. Do you want to do CVVs or?
Well, the idea was to do the CVV correction and a K2 self-flat fielding correction.
Just let's, I feel like that's where we're on this track. Let's
okay, I can try and add a bit of pace to this. So, to do the CVV, we need to import a bit. So we'll import from curve correctors. We will import the Kepler CVV corrector. So we'll make a light curve file. Again, we'll just use whatever data we have from the mission. So search light curve. And then I don't know if people recognize this phone number, but this is Tabista. Okay, and we we'll work, of course. So we make our light curve. So we extract the simple aperture photometry flux, because this PDC flux has already been corrected with CBVs. So we take the SAP flux, and we can just before we do the code printing, we should remove NATs. Otherwise, it probably won't work. So, if we try to run then the Kepler CVV corrector on our light curve file, so this will find the CVVs that are connected to where the star is on the CCD and what quarter it has been observed in. And we just want to plot how they look. CVVs. And then let's do try and plot them all. Probably needs to download some CBVs.
So you're doing it on the light curve file, not the light curve?
Yeah, we'll do it. I mean, it knows that it should do it on the SAP flux, as far as I know. But this is just to find the CBVs that are connected to the star. So there'll be different CBVs for the different CCDs that the star land on. So you need to download the proper ones. So we can try and plot that. So these are the first 8 CBVs. So you can see that this star landed on module 16, output 4, and quarter 8. So these are the CBVs that are connected to that. but as far as I know, the CBV corrector knows that it should not correct PDC flux.